myself almost entirely to the two-volume Life by Dr. Howard and Mrs. Geraldine Taylor. My choice, if by some mischance I were ever to be asked to contribute to the Evangelical Times series of books that changed me. The volumes I have with me are inscribed as a Christian gift to the young lady who 7 years later became my wife. And I may add that our first child has Hudson as his third Christian name. Secondly, I've made no change to modern Chinese nomenclature. Doubtless laziness and obstinacy explain it. To me, Peking is still Peking. I ignore this modern Beijing nonsense. I should, of course, have read Jim Broomhall's multi-volume history of the China Inland Mission. I borrowed the first volume a number of years ago, and then have to confess that I retired from the battle defeated by the new spellings. A word on the biography. J.C. Pollock, in his Hudson Taylor and Maria, observes that Mrs. Taylor presents a very Victorian, sanitized account. I don't disagree. But however hagiographical, it was written by a couple who had exceptional opportunity to note weaknesses and failures. Personally, I can't speak happily without a text. Please, therefore, allow me one. Hudson Taylor's translation of the Greek text of Mark 11:22, when he was revising the Romanized Ningpo New Testament. Take hold of the faithfulness of God. Perfect summary of his life and work. Born on the 21st of May, 1832, his life almost exactly coincided with the reign of Queen Victoria, 40 years after the commencement of the modern missionary movement. It was the period of rapid industrialization and commercialism, exploration and colonialism, the age of gas and electricity, railways and steamships. The founding of the CIM in 1865 followed hard upon the revival of 1859 onwards, and the latter part of the century is marked by the evangelistic missions of Moody and Sankey, Chapman and Alexander, by the ministry of Spurgeon, developments such as the Oxford Movement, the Brethren, Keswick, the nonconformist expansion, and the nonconformist conscience. Hudson was the first child of James and Amelia, nay Hudson, and the great-grandson of a stonemason, James, who was converted on his wedding day in 1776. He founded a long succession of faith, continued to my own knowledge, to Hudson's own great-grandson, James Hudson Taylor III, a fairly recent general director of the Overseas Missionary Fellowship. James, the father, was a pharmacist and lay preacher. The mother was the daughter of a Methodist minister, a godly, orderly woman in a well-disciplined household. Hudson was rather delicate and was educated at home, apart from 2 years at 11 plus, a nearby school in their hometown of Barnsley. There's evidence of spirituality in early years, but he dated his conversion to the age of 17. 2 years before, he had taken a post in a local bank, his father being convinced that a thorough business training would always be valuable. But it was a poor time spiritually, with worldly companions in the bank to turn his mind away from godliness. The interlude was to prove invaluable when, as general director of a great mission, he ensured that its business affairs were conducted with efficiency and promptitude. It grew to 900 members in his time. One Saturday afternoon, looking for something to read, he picked up a tract, purposing to read the story and lay it down when he got to the moral. But the words, "the finished work of Christ," arrested him, and the Holy Spirit applied them savingly. His mother was away from home, but he told his young sister, Amelia, and secured her promise not to say anything. Later, he saw a note in her 13-year-old's diary, made a month previously, that she would pray daily for her brother until he was saved. When his mother returned home, he told her he had news for her. She replied, "I know already." That same afternoon, she had locked herself in her room where she was staying, determined to wait upon God until she was sure of her son's conversion. The assurance came as she prayed. No wonder Hudson Taylor believed in prayer. That was June 1849. Very early, he was strongly drawn to seek holiness and to spread the gospel. With Amelia, he gave up attending the evening service at the chapel to distribute tracts and to witness in the poorest parts of Barnsley. Of course, temptation was real, and failures brought him almost to despair, but also to the great moment of youthful decision. He went aside to bargain with God. If only God would give victory over sin, he would devote himself unreservedly to his service. In his own words, he would go anywhere, do anything, suffer whatever his cause might demand, and be wholly given to his will and service. Never shall I forget the feeling that came over me. I felt I was in the presence of God, entering into the covenant with the Almighty. I felt as though I wished to withdraw my promise, but couldn't. And from that time, the conviction never left me that I was called to China. The next few years were exceptionally important years of deliberate preparation for the day in September 1853 when he embarked for a 5.5-month voyage to China at the age of 21. He learned of what missionary work was being done and became interested in what was to be the Chinese Evangelization Society. He worked as assistant in his father's shop, studying medicine, maths, Latin and Greek as best he could. Then in May 1851, he moved to Hull to assist a Dr. Hardy, married to an aunt on his mother's side. There was another strong attraction. Amelia had gone to Barton, across the Humber, to work with an aunt who ran a school, and where there was also a young music teacher, a Christian girl, to whom Hudson was strongly attracted. The advantages for his medical education were obvious, but the greater importance was in the training for his peculiar calling as a pioneer faith missionary. After a while, the circumstances of his lodging changed, and he found that he was unable to tithe his gross income without moving. So he found a room on Drainside with a Christian woman whose husband was a merchant navy officer. at a rental of 3 shillings a week, he found by economical self-catering, he could give not a tenth, but 2/3 of his salary. He assured his mother in a letter that he was looking after himself properly. He tells her that he was eating biscuits, as cheap as bread, at 18 pence a stone, and herring without butter, at 3 a penny, and 1/2 a one is sufficient. Cheese at 4 pence a pound, which would cost 6 to 8 pence in Barnsley. He comments, "So you see, at little expense, I enjoy many comforts." But the great point of his training was to prove that he could trust God to supply his needs, for he knew of no agency that would send him to China. He was attending a meeting of the Brethren in Hull, which was in touch with George Muller's orphanage work in Bristol. Hudson determined to follow Muller's practice and ask God, and only God, for needed supplies. Dr. Hardy's forgetfulness over money afforded good opportunities. A retrospect, written many years later, gives account of several notable interventions at the last moment. For instance, one of the doctor's richest patients came to pay his bill late on a Saturday night, just in time. Or, most strikingly, when he gave his last coin to a starving Irish family the day before he was due to pay the rent for his room. And God supplied. By August 1852, he decided to go to London to further his medical studies. And he gave up the girl to whom he was attached. He was now accepted as a potential missionary of the China Evangelization Society. They offered to meet his expenses, and so did his father. His own decision was to refuse both offers, leaving each party to suppose the alternative offer had been accepted. He had an uncle living in a boarding house where he was able to share a room with Tom Hodson, a cousin from Barton. By self-catering, he was able to live on very little. To him, trusting God to supply did not allow anything but the barest possible minimum of unavoidable expense. His diet comprised a tuppenny brown loaf and a few apples daily, and water to drink. To walk 4 miles to the London hospital, study, and walk the wards. The regime didn't last many months, for his life was almost lost to an infection contracted in the dissecting room. But the year didn't end before Tom Hodson was converted. In the new year, he obtained a post as assistant to a city surgeon. He lived with the Browns family, shared their meals, and had only a mile to walk to the London. The conversion of a bitterly antagonistic patient of Mr. Brown's remained an encouragement for many, many years. But things were happening in China. The Taiping Rebellion threatened to overthrow the government, and its leader was a Christian convert who made the distribution of the scriptures as much an objective as the conquest of Peking. The British and Foreign Bible Society agreed to print 1 million Chinese New Testaments. The CES, Chinese Evangelization Society, decided that their promising recruit should leave without completing his medical course. Funds were abundant at the time. Now, it's completely impossible to overemphasize the importance of the term of 6 years in China that followed, and indeed the whole period of 12 years before the CIM was founded. What the new mission became stemmed from Hudson Taylor's experience, first at the CES. Its missionaries were agents tied to detailed rules and regulations and directed by a committee in London, almost as far from China as was geographically possible. Secondly, the CIM was moulded by his experiences in Hull and London. He sailed from Liverpool in the Dumfries, a 470-ton sailing ship, which barely survived a storm in the Irish Sea and another in the China Sea. It arrived after 5.5 months at Shanghai in March 1854. Taylor had 3 letters of introduction. The first was to a man who had died shortly before, the second to a man who had left for America, and the third, given by a comparative stranger, to Dr. Medhurst of the London Mission. Shanghai was occupied by rebel soldiers, not the Taiping insurgents, and besieged by the Imperial Army. No lodging was to be found in the international settlement or elsewhere. He was accommodated on the LMS compound, sharing a home with a young CMS couple, Mr. and Mrs. Burden. His early experiences were both normal, learning a difficult language and fitting into a strange culture, and extremely peculiar. The CES was determined not to build, but had no advice as to how he was to live. His annual allowance was £80 a year with a letter of credit to double it for emergencies. This proved entirely inadequate in the conditions of war and inflation. Letters to London produced no answer to the problems. Diligent searching produced, but only for a short time, a house in the Chinese city, and first experiences of direct missionary work with the help of his Christian language teacher. The Burden's home became available with Mrs. Burden's death, which he shared with American missionaries just in time to welcome CES reinforcements. A doctor and Mrs. Parker and 3 young children. They came with neither cash nor letters of credit. Those days in Hull were not in vain. But Hudson was learning how not to run a mission. Over a period of little more than 12 months, Hudson made 10 evangelistic journeys outside Shanghai, usually with more experienced workers. He saw the enormity of the task of evangelizing China, still closed, in theory, to permanent residents outside the treaty ports. Everywhere he met crowds, temples, idols, and total ignorance of the gospel. And everywhere tracts and gospels were received eagerly, and medical work procured friendly response. A visit to the port of Ningpo resulted in an invitation to Dr. Parker to open a hospital there to serve the needs of the missionary body active in the town. So, in 1855, still only 23 years, after much searching, the day before the Parkers were to move, he found a little house in Shanghai. 2, he received a direct gift from an English businessman, a Mr. Berger. 3, he met Barella and Maria Dyer, young sisters with fluent Chinese, who assisted a Miss Annesley in a school for girls in Ningpo, the pioneering missionary activity in the city. 4, he baptized Huai Hua, his servant inquirer, the first fruits of the later harvest. 5, upon leaving the Parkers, he went to a barber to have his head shaved, a queue plaited, and to go to his new home, to adopt Chinese dress for the first time. It was his first outstanding innovation in missionary practice and earned him the contempt of fellow Europeans and the disapproval, almost without exception, of the missionary community. Soon he was living on the island of Sung Ming, visited on one of the evangelistic journeys, aided by Huai Hua and an inquirer named Cien, and gathering a group of new inquirers. It was so encouraging and so short-lived. The British consul ordered him to leave. A deposition had been lodged against him, and the Nanking Treaty, 1842, I think, only allowed residence in a treaty port. At this vital juncture, he met William Burns, the Scottish revivalist of nearly 30 years before. And then, and for many years, a faithful missionary to China. He had left his flock at Amoy to others and came to the Yangtze in the hope of reaching the Taiping leaders. Instead, he reached Hudson Taylor, made one evangelistic journey with him, and then joined with the young man in 6 months' pioneering work in the southern port of Swatow. Burns seemed to know nothing of secondary causes. The one great cause was God. For Hudson, it meant so much, learning of revival and persecution, and of God's providential control, whatever the circumstance. Burns adopted Chinese dress and never abandoned it. The Swatow work eventually prospered greatly, but it was hard going at first. Despite the great age difference, they worked effectively together and only separated when Hudson returned to Shanghai to collect medical equipment and medicines. In fact, they never met again. The great lesson of divine sovereignty was underlined. Medical supplies had been destroyed in the fire, in a fire in the LMS compound. An attempt to borrow from Dr. Parker in Ningpo failed because of theft on the journey. Finally, just as he was about to go on board to sail to Swatow, a message came through that Mr. Burns had been arrested and removed from the port. The outcome was that Hudson Taylor removed to Ningpo to work with new CES colleagues of Mr. and Mrs. Jones. They commenced work in a house which, well into the 20th century, was the oldest centre of the CIM. I select 5 issues from the ensuing 4 years in Ningpo. 1. The work was amazingly fruitful, not with vast numbers, but in that pioneering situation, with a dozen converts of such quality that they all became home missionaries. One was still working with the CIM 50 years later. Hudson and the Joneses, both said of their connection with the CES amicably. The society had gone into debt, and their workers were unhappy over it and prepared to trust God directly for supplies. This was at a time when they were feeding 60 or more of the very poorest each day. 3. Hudson and Maria Dyer formed an attachment that was to lead to marriage, a love story that Pollock's book majors upon. The friendship was bitterly and intemperately opposed by Miss Aldersey, and of course no contact was possible in the 1850s. Astonishingly, Maria's guardian in England gave his permission for the marriage. 4. Dr. Parker's wife died, leaving him with 4 little children to take home to relatives in Scotland. He invited Hudson to run at least the hospital dispensary. The work among the Chinese had been sustained by Dr. Parker's private practice. But Taylor maintained the whole hospital work on a faith basis, with the eager cooperation of the converts of his work in the town. Evangelistically, the hospital was gloriously fruitful by the standard of those pioneering days. 5. Hudson Taylor made his first appeal for new workers. His own health was collapsing under the strain of various illnesses and overwork. But opportunities were abounding and ever increasing. He was praying for 5 new workers, but soon his own life was despaired of. The hospital was closed and they sailed for England in July 1860, accompanied by one of the earliest converts, Wong Lai Jun, who left his wife and child to look after the missionaries on the voyage and in England. I'm not sure whether to make this or the founding of this China Inland Mission the halfway point in the narrative. Hudson's health improved sufficiently to permit him to embark on hard work upon arrival. The Reverend F.F. Gough of the CMS was at home and undertook the revision of the Ningpo New Testament with Hudson. For 4 years, the revision and resumed medical studies absorbed most of his time, and only one of the new missionaries prayed for was accepted and sent out. He was James Meadows, also from Barnsley, who worked more than 50 years with the CIM. Appeals to existing agencies to adopt inland China as a field of work elicited no more than sympathy. Meanwhile, the years at home produced innovative principles of missionary practice, which I suggest cannot be listed in an order of importance. 1. The direction of the work was to be on the field by the leader, the only experienced worker, Hudson Taylor himself. At home, Mr. Berger, whose interest went back to pre-China days, would assess and send candidates, transmit funds as they came, keep out of debt, keep in touch with supporters, and encourage prayer. 2. There was to be no appeal for funds. So it was thought the spiritual needs of China could be advertised without the danger of reducing support of other workers. 3. The type of worker sought should not be limited to academics or clergy, but ordinary men and women with a passion for souls, whatever their secular qualifications. 4. With such a vast field to occupy, there was room for workers of any evangelical denomination, so long as they believed the essentials of the gospel, and this was regarded as sufficient ground for cooperative effort. The pastor of the Baptist church with which the Taylors associated in London was editor of the Baptist magazine. His request for a series of articles on the Ningpo mission resulted in study and preparation of a publication under the title China's Spiritual Need and Claims. Taylor was himself overwhelmed by the need revealed. The thought of 1 million a month in China dying without God was too much for him. In the end, on June the 25th, 1865, on Brighton Beach, he made the great decision. Nobody else would do it, so he couldn't escape the responsibility himself. The next day, he paid £10 into the bank under the name China Inland Mission. Then things took off. The publication appealed for 24 workers, 2 for each promise, for each province. By the end of the year, there were 20 or 30 candidates, wanting to join the eight by then already in China. The year ended with a solemn day of prayer and fasting, and with thankfulness that Maria had been spared a second near-fatal illness since their marriage. On May the 26th, 1866, the Lammermuir sailed with the Taylor family and new recruits, a party of 18 adults and 4 children. It was a notable voyage, with the conversion of the unsaved members of the crew, dissent among a few of the recruits, and a typhoon which brought them at last into Shanghai, little better than a wreck. It was the largest party of missionaries to reach China up to that time. Very soon, in Chinese costume, they were opening new stations inland, in great cities like Hangzhou and Yangzhou, Xinjiang, even Nanking, 24-hour days travel away. Those early days were marked by extraordinary fruitfulness and exceptional trials. Within a year, there were as many as a dozen baptismal candidates in Hangzhou. But it was marked, too, by the death of the eldest of the Taylor's 5 children, Grace, who had been converted by seeing the transformation of members of the crew of the Lammermuir. Most seriously, a very few of the recruits went back on the principles they'd accepted, reverted to Western dress, and provoked, in effect, riots which endangered the lives of missionaries and nationals and resulted in the withdrawals from stations opened. Troubles came to the ears of consular officials and even the British Parliament. The unfriendly fueled the flames with complaints and misrepresentations. Income from Britain fell, and for several years George Muller, himself depending solely on God's provision in answer to prayer, was a major source of material supply. It's hardly to be wondered that these early years of advance into the most populous, unreached mission field should meet with such opposition. But that opposition was prolonged and intense. In the midst of it, Hudson himself and many of the missionaries were much refreshed spiritually by what was to become the Keswick movement. The emphasis was on the Christian's resources in Christ to be experienced through faith. I quote, "But how to get faith strengthened? Not by striving after faith, but by resting on the faithful one." John 15 became particularly relevant and helpful with its theme of identification with Christ. Hudson Taylor certainly regarded this as a crisis in his spiritual life, and just when most needed. On top of the numerous trials in the gospel advance, there came the birth in July 1870 of a 5th son, Noel, to be lost within a week and within a fortnight of Maria herself. She was only 33, and Hudson Taylor's confidant and most experienced and effective missionary. Miss Blatchley had been, as Maria herself, an efficient secretarial helper, but she was in England with the surviving children. A Mr. C.T. Fish had been a year in China and had helped in their place and was appointed field secretary at the close of the year. But Hudson was ill and needing to return to England. Mr. and Mrs. Berger needed to retire from their responsibilities, and arrangements at home would have to be revised. From now onwards, the record of advance in the evangelizing of China doesn't involve very much of novelty, though there are aspects to which attention must be drawn. Maria had desired Hudson to marry again, for his own sake as well as for the children and the mission. And when he was brought into close contact with Miss Faulding, sisterhood and the life of the women's work in Hangzhou. An affection developed, which issued in their marriage in 1872. A council was formed to take over Mr. Berger's responsibilities, and after more than a year at home, Hudson returned to China to visit missionaries and nationals and to help revive work where problems had arisen and the work had declined. Already, when in England, prayer had been made for 18 new workers to enter the unoccupied provinces. Soon there was increased blessing and a gift of £800 for fresh promises, for fresh provinces. For regular work, often supplies were barely adequate. On one occasion, they were down to 67 cents. But nothing was allowed to interrupt the spreading of the gospel. The illness and death of the missionary who had been looking after the children brought Hudson back to England in 1874 to find the Saturday prayer meeting discontinued, the children scattered, and the recruits slow to appear. Hudson had fallen when travelling on the Yangtze and was now crippled and confined to bed. But he dictated an appeal for prayer for the 9 unopened provinces. The 18 began to come, and the funds. On one occasion, receipts had been £235 less than the average expenditure for the period to be covered. They stopped work for special prayer, and that evening, the postman brought the letter with a check from the sale of plate for £235, 7 and 9 pence. Similar incidents could be quoted. Gradually, Hudson returned to a measure of physical fitness and launched an illustrated monthly magazine, China's Millions, very much an innovation at the time. Hudson Taylor would sometimes say that there were commonly 3 stages in work for God. First, impossible. Then, difficult. Then, done. It was impossible to enter the 9 unopened provinces until in September 1876, the Chifu Convention signed by the Chinese government opened the whole of China to foreign travellers. Then it began to happen. And in 18 months, CIM pioneers traversed 30,000 miles selling or distributing scriptures everywhere. The next major advance began in 1871, when a survey of needs had opportunities of needs and opportunities showed that there was urgent need for at least another 50 or 60 workers to add to a mission of barely 100. So the prayer was made for the 70, other 70 also, as in the gospel. And in 1883, one of the missionaries, Dr. Harold Schofield, died, but died praying, deeply burdened by the need for university graduates to follow him, an outstanding prize winner, to China. Hence, the Cambridge Seven of 1885, including Stanley Smith, the stroke of the Cambridge boat, C.D. Stout, the Cambridge and England cricketer, and D.E. Host, the army officer who was to be Hudson Taylor's successor. The story of the Cambridge Seven is told by J.C. Pollock in his book of that title. By 1886, the CIM had adopted a more developed structure, and superintendents for the different provinces, reception houses for new missionaries, and a deputy director, J.W. Stevenson, one of the most senior workers. From him came a letter from Shanxi to say that they were praying for 100 fresh labourers in 1887. Hudson Taylor took up the suggestion and added to it prayer for £10,000 of additional income to meet the extra costs, and in large gifts to minimise the extra work involved. No appeal for money was made, but £11,000 of additional funds were received in 11 gifts. And out of more than 600 who offered for service, 102 were sent out in that year. Among the visitors to CIM headquarters in London in 1887 was an American named Henry Frost. He came to persuade Hudson to establish an American council to feed men and money for China on the faith basis of the China Inland Mission. But he got nowhere. A similar organisation to the CIM was suggested instead. Mr. Frost returned to America disappointed. However, he knew that Hudson Taylor was shortly to return to China and could travel via America. Invitations were given and accepted. But the result was far beyond Hudson's expectations. Little known when he arrived in July, he left with a band of young workers, chosen out of more than 40 who had offered to the CIM and with gifts and prayer support. Thus it had become a pioneer in international missionary activity, as well as it had pioneered earlier into denominational work. That visit was only the beginning. Later, auxiliaries came into being in Canada and Australia, and Swedish and German associate missions. It was in 1889, at the age of 57, that Hudson Taylor received a new call. He was at Hastings in the home of Mrs. Taylor's father. He read the words, "Preach the gospel to every creature," and took it as an unfulfilled command. Surely, it had to be taken literally. The last decade of his active service began there with a will to obey. How? He worked it out. 1,000,000 is 1,000 thousands. Given 1,000 evangelists, each one teaching 250 people daily, and in 1,000 days, 250 millions would have the offer of divine mercy. Surely, a task that could, at that rate, be accomplished in little over 3 years shouldn't be thought beyond the resources of the Christian Church. Hudson recalled his days with William Burns and how they had not found it difficult to reach 500 to 1,000 people daily, preaching in all the streets of a given town or city and entering every shop with books or tracts. The thought was not of curtailing present work, but rather going beyond it and using the Christians, missionaries, and nationals already serving God in this and other ways. So in the December edition of China's Millions, a paper appeared entitled "To Every Creature." He saw prayer as the first priority, but he was about to go to China to preach at the Second General Missionary Conference. He chose the feeding of the multitude as his topic. His draft included these words, "I'm so glad it was a great multitude, so great that the disciples thought it impossible to feed them. Yet the multitude were in real need, and the need was immediate. The size of the multitude presented no difficulty, nor the smallness of supplies." Amazingly, if experience is anything to go by, the conference issued the appeal for the 1,000 for all kinds of missionary work in China within the next 5 years on behalf of 300 millions of unevangelized heathen. And great numbers of new missionaries came in answer to the appeal, and multitudes did hear the gospel. throughout its history, the CIM had never lost a life through violence. That was about to change. It was in 1900 that the Dowager Empress issued the inflammatory edict which led to the attempt by the Boxers to exterminate all foreigners. There was concern over the state of things in China, and overwork led to a breakdown of Hudson's health. He reached England in June, and Mrs. Taylor arranged for the journey to continue to the Alps, to Davos. There the news of the martyrdoms as they occurred could be held back for a while. 58 CIM missionaries and 21 children were killed, and many who survived suffered dreadfully. Hudson Taylor was now quite frail, and in the autumn of 1902, he handed over his position to D.E. Host, remaining in Switzerland with his wife until she died of cancer 2 years later. Hudson's last year was spent, as health improved sufficiently, visiting America and then again China. He visited the cemetery at Xinjiang, where Maria and four of their children were buried, and finally went on by steamer to Hankow. And last of all, he died in Changsha at the age of 73. To be taken to Xinjiang for burial beside his beloved Maria. My final quotation is from J.W. Stevenson, Deputy Director of the CIM. Oh, his was a life that stood looking into, searching through and through. Get a man like Mr. Taylor and you could start any mission tomorrow. It was most wonderful, his life. I never knew any other so consistent. And I watched him year in and year out, and had exceptional opportunities for doing so. He walked with God. His life bore the light all through. And he was so gracious and accessible. Day or night, literally at all hours, he was ready to help in sickness or any trouble, for self-denial and practical consecration. One could not feel that he did anything but stand alone. There's a memorial to Hudson Taylor in modern communist China. It's the Church of the Redeemed, numbered soberly in the multi-millions. And there's a memorial outside China too. The Overseas Missionary Fellowship, working in Taiwan and Japan, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, the headquarters of the mission. Great is thy faithfulness. I can never read the life of Hudson Taylor without being encouraged again and again to take hold of the faithfulness of God.